Right now, it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game in the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Emily. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
Hey, how are things in beautiful Los Angeles?
They're beautiful. It rained the other day, too, so it feels great out here.
I understand you guys, were you guys worried about a tsunami? Was that happening this week?
Yeah, off the coast of Chile. We were feeling some reverberations from that on the coast, but I think everything's okay.
But no tsunami?
Not as far as I know.
Dang. Well, welcome to the show, Emily. You're going to play our game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Bill, what is Emily's topic?
Thou art most awesome sauce.
So, we tend to think of certain words as very much part of our present culture. But this week we learned that a certain word or phrase dates back much further than previously thought. Our panel is going to tell you about it. So your job is to pick the one that is telling the truth, and you will win our prize, Carl Castle's voice in your voicemail. Are you ready to do this?
I'm so ready.
First, let's hear from Amy Dickinson.
A small team of academics from Georgetown University were researching the impact of cowardice on historical events when they found this phrase popping up in surprising places. It's not you, it's me. Sure, we all know that Jerry Seinfeld said it, and Brad Pitt said it to Jennifer Aniston just before he became Brangelina. But did you know that Brutus said it to Julius Caesar? Sus vobis ego sum, he whispered just before the stabbing, in Latin. Cleopatra wrote this in a note, which she had a minion deliver to Mark Antony. Most surprisingly, the researchers uncovered an early draft of the Declaration of Independence, which began, "We hold this truth to be self-evident. Great Britain, it's not you, it's us." The research team got so excited about their findings that they decided to test the impact of the phrase in their own lives. And now, 10 months later, all of the researchers have left their jobs in academia, two are campaigning for Donald Trump, and one is working for Roger Goodell. Their book, It Really Isn't Me, It's You, comes out this fall.
It's not you, it's me, goes back much further than the recent book about dating. Your next story of a new phrase with an ancient past comes from Peter Gross.
Being a word historian can often be a boring job, right up there with being an accountant or James Carville's barber. But sometimes you do something fun, like discovering the origins of a curse word. Now, since the word I will be discussing is a four-letter word beginning with F that you can't say on non-Howard Stern radio shows, I'm going to use a substitute word that's basically as close as we can get without getting in trouble. See if you can catch it. This week, Dr. Paul Booth, a historian at Keele University in England, found what just may be the earliest reference dating from the year 1310 of the word fork, which is, again, not the actual word. The reference is to a man known in legal documents as, quote, Roger Forked by the Navel. Dr. Booth said he thinks this man, who historians believe constantly insisted that everyone just call him Roger, was not burdened by the worst family name in history, but rather he was given the name as an insult. This surname is presumably a nickname, Dr. Booth told the website medievalists.net, a site devoted to Middle Ages history, not Mike Huckabee's views on gay marriage. Booth thinks the nickname could actually refer to an attempt at fornication by the inexperienced young Roger, who chose the navel as his, let's say, point of entry with a young lady. The embarrassing episode may have later been reported by Roger's confused and presumably very dissatisfied girlfriend, which led to the unfortunate nickname. So, the next time someone cuts you off in traffic and you're tempted to scream, "Fork you!" try yelling, "You are the type of person who would attempt to copulate with someone's belly button." It's a lot longer, but still historically accurate.
So the F-bomb, if it were, going back much, much further than we thought. And your last story of a modern phrase not being so modern comes from Adam Burke.
To anyone who has spent hours burning their retinas out in front of Netflix or Hulu, it's a term that's all too familiar, binge watch. However, while that particular practice is a newer phenomenon, it seems the term has been around for some time, although with a different connotation. As the phrase was being submitted for consideration for a recent update to the Oxford English Dictionary, junior editor Reynold Cox pointed out the phrase binge watch, translated from the Latin gula vigilia, has existed for centuries and once referred to the ancient Roman practice of appointing a person at feasts and orgies to ensure that people didn't overindulge, i.e. a designated binge watcher. The first known use was found on a terracotta tablet looking for people willing to perform odd or peculiar jobs in exchange for gold or salt, which historians called an early, less gross version of Craigslist. By the 18th century, the English version of the idiom was popular enough to prompt the poet Alexander Pope to include it in a humorous rhyming couplet to his friend William Congreve, advising him to watch his intake of food and wine. Unless to your belt you'd fain add a notch, I'd deign to serve as a vigilant binge watch.
All right, one of these words or phrases goes back much further in time than we thought. Was it from Amy Dickinson? It's not you, it's me. That classic breakup line. Turns out Brutus used it on Caesar. From Peter Gross, well, the most familiar F-bomb, which we thought was fairly modern, but isn't, going back to the 14th century. Or from Adam Burke, the phrase binge watch originally meant, you know, somebody watching someone binge. Which of these is the real story of a interesting discovery in the world of language?
It's a tough one, but I think I'm going to have to go with Adam's story about binge watching.
Really? You're going to go to Adam's story about how binge watching originally meant watching someone binge so as to make sure they were doing it well. Well, we actually spoke to the researcher who actually made this discovery.
A couple of weeks ago, I very unexpectedly came across a man with a very, very unusual name, Roger by the Navel.
Yeah, amazingly, they also had bleeps in the early 14th century. That was Paul Booth, a retired senior lecturer at the University of Liverpool, talking about his four-letter discovery. All right. I have some good news and some bad news. The bad news, of course, is that you didn't win. Adam fooled you with his, I thought, very charming story about binge watching. The real story was obviously Peter's. The good news is, first, that you won a point for Adam for being, shall we say, convincing, and that you now know if you ever use foul language like that, you can point out, oh, no, no, I'm using historically accurate English. Emily, thank you for playing our game.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Keep going.